Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about snowshoeing and other winter activities today to begin the show with our guest, Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports, also an avid winter sportsman. He loves snowshoeing, teaches workshops on how to build your own snowshoes. He's done winter camping, cross-country skiing. So he knows a lot, and I hope you'll join in today. Maybe you're a snowshoer. What do you enjoy about it, or questions about it, or other winter sports? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Darren Bush, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always great.
Pretty good snow cover across Wisconsin right now. It's been a bit cold, but you've been out
getting
some winter sports in.
Well, that's how it works, right? You go when you can go.
Yeah.
I was up in Marquette in December, and I forgot. I didn't take a raincoat. Because who needs a raincoat in the UP in December? Well, I needed a raincoat. So we actually have more snow here than some of the places up north.
Yeah. Well, we have plenty of snow around. And snowshoes, which I really enjoy snowshoeing. Unfortunately, I've got a knee problem, that ankle, and then I think that radiated to my knee, which has kind of screwed me up for getting out there. But I really enjoy it. Where do you love to snowshoe in Wisconsin?
Pretty much anywhere there's snow.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at Donald County Park over by Mount Vernon day before yesterday with my wife, and it was wonderful, and didn't see many people there. We go in from the equestrian parking side,
mm-hmm.
and nobody goes there. They all go in the other side on the far west. And we didn't see a soul. It was great.
Oh, so that's one great place to snowshoe.
Yeah. I mean, around here, that's great. The Blue Mounds has some snowshoe trails. They're usually a little bit compacted. Mm-hmm. The Arboretum, when it first snows, is nice. But there's an etiquette to grooming, right? When they groom for cross country skiing, you don't want to walk in it, so you walk to the side of it just not to mess up the tracks. But there up north, there's all sorts of great places. Any place you can hike, you can generally snowshoe. The Wisconsin tourism site, Travel Wisconsin, has a list of great hiking and snowshoe trails, so I would check that out.
Yeah, a good place to go to check that is to check that out for sure. How'd you get into it, by the way? Did you... Something you just grew up with, or
no? I grew up in California, so,
so
there's precious little snowshoe. I saw snow for the first time when I was about 12.
Oh,
as a Boy Scout, we went up into the mountains, and it was very interesting and weird and cool. So, when I moved here, obviously you bloom where you're planted, right? And you do mm-hmm. the activities that fit where you are. And my wife was pregnant with our daughter, who is now 35, and we were homebound in this efficiency apartment we lived in. We were both students. We were just about to graduate. And I said, we need to get out of town. And so we saw, pre-internet, obviously, somewhere about Mosquito Hill Nature Center up in New London was having a snowshoe building class. And I said, well, that'd be fun. So I built my first pair of snowshoes in 1987 in New London, Wisconsin, at the Mosquito Hill Nature Center. And I just finished pair 102.
Which is on its way to Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's on its way to Minnesota, by Rochester. Yeah.
And you've taught classes yourself.
I have, yeah. It's been a few years since I have, just because it's a time-consuming process. I am going to teach some classes up north. I'm working on basically to try and work with North House Folk School up in Grand Marais, Minnesota. They have a snowshoe class that the teacher, I think, is, I don't know if he's going to retire soon or just trying to scale back, but I'm working with those guys to take over for him at some point.
Well, just looking at our callers, there's some callers online. You can join in. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. email to ideas@wpr.org. Just on the snowshoe line here, there's traditional, there's the modern. I happen to have the modern type of tubs, I think. You have tubs.
Sure.
But just talk maybe about the differences and so forth.
Well, the more surface area you have, the more flotation you have. And the modern shoes generally are solid deck, so you can get pretty much an exact idea how much surface area there is. With traditional shoes, it's a little more complex because since snow sticks to itself, you can have those holes, right? And so you mm-hmm. see the webbing that's laced together. It doesn't all come up through the holes, right? Because the snow sticks to itself. So that actually gives it quite a bit of flotation. I've got, I don't know how many pair I have, but the one I was using with my wife they're 12 by 60 Ojibwe's. And the snow was probably about 14, 15 inches deep out there at Donald County Park. And I was thinking about 4 inches.
Yeah.
So quite a difference.
Yeah, quite a difference indeed. Frank in Springbrook has a comment, maybe a question. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Say, I just wanted to make a comment up here north of Wisconsin. I'm looking out my window. We've probably got 2 or 3 inches of snow. There's a real concern about whether the American Birkenbinder is going to be held the full course, from Cable to Hayward. Those are ongoing concerns, but... I was going to ask your guest, has he ever attended that winter camping event that's held in Sawmill Park in Washburn County? I'm a reporter up here, and I've covered it a few times, and it seems like a lot of fun. And the people who come seem to have a lot of fun doing that.
I haven't been to the one in Washburn County. There's one in southern Wisconsin out in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve that's Wisconsin Winter Camping Symposium or something like that. It used to be in Solon Springs, and Dwayne and Margot Laudig ran it, and they're the ones that own Snow Trekker Tents. And they're the ones that made my winter tent. And this year it was in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, and I wasn't able to make it.
Yeah, what are they like, Frank? What's the one in Washburn County like?
Well, I haven't covered it in a couple of years, but it's a group primarily from northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota, and I think they belong to some organization. And that tent maker you mentioned, I think that person or that they're represented. Most people have that tent; it's like a canvas tent.
Correct.
And they have these little titanium stoves, and there are always a few people who make their own tent, and they come up with creative ways of making like their own little furnaces. And it's just a 4-day, like a 4 or 5 day celebration of getting together with friends and enjoying being out there. They always say that, there's no competition when they go out winter camping. There's no bugs. So.
Yeah, I just wrote an article for the Isthmus, which is, the paper here in Madison, the Independent, about, winter camping and tent camping. And I went out in a canoe, actually, and camped on a sandbar with a hot tent. And, one of the things I say, my favorite maxim is, if you want to have solitude, go where people aren't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And putting that barrier in definitely makes a difference. I was sure that I was the only person camping from Prairie all the way down to Wyalusing. I don't think there's anybody else on the river. And it was a wonderful experience. So, but yeah, no bugs.
No bugs.
No mosquitoes.
No people.
No people. No bugs, no people is pretty much how I roll.
Frank, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. He mentioned the stove, and I believe you mentioned in the Isthmus article you wrote.
Yeah, there's a gentleman who makes these stoves called Four Dog Stoves. And Don Cavilius, I never know if I say it right or not, but... he makes these titanium stoves that pack up into each other. They're about the size, they're probably 15 by 8 by 8, something like that. And the stove, the pipe collapses into itself, and you pull it apart and put it together. And you stick it out to the side of the tent, what's called the stove jack. And if you just had canvas, obviously, it would just burn, right?
Yeah.
But it's not asbestos, but something like that, where the pipe goes through. And, you know, I had it, it's now in my backyard. I set it up in my backyard when I'm not using it elsewhere just because it's nice. And it was 80 degrees at the ridgepole when it was, you know, zero. So those little stoves really, really crank it.
Jen in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. I just have a question about snowshoeing around the Hayward neighborhood. We're taking a long weekend this weekend and was wondering if you had any trails to recommend. I'll just listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
You know what? I don't. It's not a place that I go a lot, but I'm sure the local chamber definitely has a list. And as I said, travelwisconsin.com has a list of all the trails up there. But, yeah, I don't know all of them. I can't.
We got lots of Eau Claire listeners are in that area, Jen, so stay listening. Somebody will probably call up and tell you where a good spot is to go.
Sure.
Stay with us. Number to call, by the way, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's see here. I was going to go to Drew in Viroqua next. Drew in Viroqua, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm calling to promote Vernon Trails. We've got beautiful snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and fat tire biking trails here in Viroqua, but as your guest mentioned, Kickapoo Valley Reserve is fantastic. And this last weekend, I was at Greenbush in the north part of the Kettle Moraine State Forest, just west of Sheboygan. The snow there is utterly fantastic. It's deep and navigable for, as I mentioned, skis, snowshoes, and fat tires. But I also wanted to mention the utility of a snowshoe. As your guest mentioned, it helps you float. And now we have snowshoe trails that are really, really well packed down. People are walking on them on snowshoes. I'm in my hiking boots. I'm getting around a lot faster, a lot easier. I dare say I'm having more fun. Snowshoes are meant for deep snow. They help keep you above, just like skis do. I had a great winter living in the North Cascade Mountains about 20 years ago. We had 20 feet of snow with 6 feet on the ground at all times. You couldn't walk 10 feet a minute in that snow, but you had to have snowshoes or skis just to stay alive if you were out there.
Oh, yeah. Drew, thank you for calling, and that's a good point.
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes after, like in the Arboretum, for example, after a couple days, even a day, everything's packed down. The one small exception is the more modern shoes have crampons built in, right? The claws underneath.
Yeah.
And when you get a lot of compacted snow and it warms up a little bit, it's, you know, pretty much hard snow or soft ice, depending how you look at it. And with the weather as it is now, warming up and freezing and thawing, it's going to be a place where I would rather be in a pair of modern shoes just for that traction than I would in my wood shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. Drew, thanks again. Appreciate it. Darren Bush, our guest today, we're talking winter activities. We've zeroed in a bit on snowshoeing, but we've also gotten into tenting a little bit, and we'll take other questions as well as it relates to winter activities. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipertz, our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking winter activities outdoors today with our guest Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports. He's also an avid winter sportsman, as we're learning here. And you can join in with your questions. What's on your mind when it comes to snowshoes or winter tanning or any other winter activity for that matter? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Jerry in Kokana. Jerry, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, Darren, I have a couple questions here. One is it mostly just that crampon and the lack of maintenance of the modern snowshoes. I have the old Alaskan style, and I really like them. But how do you take care of those, and what happens if you're not diligent enough to be putting on that? I take it you probably use a spar varnish or something. Can you talk about upkeeping your wooden snowshoes?
Sure.
Yeah, that's easy. So wooden frame snowshoes, they're usually ash and nice and straight grain. The biggest wear area is right under your foot. And it doesn't mean, because sometimes people walk across the road at like Governor Dodge, and I'm just cringing. But also just sharp snow. I mean, snow crystals are abrasive, and you can wear down the varnish underneath the footbed. A good spar varnish is useful. I don't like the stuff from big box stores because it doesn't have much urethane in it. The best spar varnish is the most flexible one. So I use Pettit, which is the house brand from West Marine, which has a high urethane content. It's very flexible, which helps especially when you're varnishing the laces. But Epiphanes is good too. Any if it costs less than $15 a quart, you probably don't want to use it. I think the stuff I get is, it's about $35 a quart and super flexible.
So, Jerry, there you go. And what's the name again of it?
Pettit.
Pettit.
P-E-T-T-I-T.
All right.
It's just that it's the house brand from West Marine, and it's very, very good. I've used it for years.
Years and years. Okay. And if typically, does anything break? I mean, laces might break, I would have guessed.
Well, that's a question I didn't really understand and didn't ask, is there's two kinds of lacing. There's a synthetic lace, which you'll see a lot on some of the tubs, that's usually made out of a neoprene that's reinforced with some fibers in it. Or there's a traditional, you know, rawhide.
Yeah.
The rawhide requires a little bit of maintenance. The biggest problem I've seen with that is mice. So people will call me and say, hey, I got my grandpa's shoes and they're awesome. But man, this mouse got in and chewed a bunch of stuff out of the hole. And that's repairable. I've repaired a few pairs for friends. Not my favorite thing to do because lacing with rawhide's like lacing with really smelly linguine. I mean, it's disgusting. But the biggest problem is cracked frames. And that comes from basically walking over a log or someplace where you bridge the snowshoe between two solid objects.
Yeah.
And that's the most common thing that I see.
Oh, and when you've done that...
They hang up in a bar someplace. We call them wall hangers, yeah.
Oh, man. Jerry, thank you for calling. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? Great show, as always. Lately I'm in my 50s. I'm trying to become more like my dad or more like a man, if you will. And I've got a list of things I'm trying to get into. I've already done the whiskey and the cigars. Now I'm at fly fishing, and I've heard that there's a bunch of great fly fishing in Wisconsin, and I'm curious if anyone does that in the winter.
Actually, yes. Catch and release season just opened. But most of the creeks were frozen up. About 80% of them were frozen. It's still catch and release season. And the southwestern part of Wisconsin, don't get me started, there's, I think, 4,000 miles of fishable Class A water. It's these fantastic little, tributaries of tributaries have really nice trout in them.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of, does the DNR have a listing of trout streams?
Yes, they do. Trout Unlimited does as well. If you want to fish southwestern Wisconsin, Driftless Angler and Viroqua is, I would recommend them highly. They're really smart folks and know it better than anybody that I know.
Yeah, Dave, there you go. So you can get out there now. In fact, you're right. The catch and release season just started.
Yep.
Good luck. Appreciate the call. Georgia in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. I'd like to talk a little bit about accessibility. My partner was a Berkey skier and had a stroke, and now he skis with a sit ski. It was provided by the CXC organization in Madison. He sits on a chair with skis on it and propels himself with his right arm.
And so, and there is an event at the Birkebeiner that is called the Paraberke that people go to who are disabled and not able to do the, you know, the stand-up Berkey or the full Berkey. And also there's an organization called Accessibility that provides track chairs for the disabled to get out in the woods. So, and I don't know if your guest knows of other opportunities. We're always looking for those.
Yeah.
Yeah, the accessibility folks come to Cunicopia. They're lovely people. For paddling, for snowshoeing, it's walking. So,
yeah,
you know, but, for paddling, there's a gentleman over in Chatham, Minnesota, which is not too far from Rochester, and his website is called, it's Creating Ability. And his name's Kevin Carr and has a daughter with a disability and has invented, all sorts of different things to make paddling more accessible. But as far as the winter stuff, there's people that know far more about it than I do.
Yeah. All right. Georgia, thank you for calling and bringing that up. It's a good reminder. And those accessible tracks that go into the woods that I've seen them in action. You can get around pretty well on those.
Well, I find the Olympics interesting, but I find the Paralympics inspiring. And watching people race, you know, 50 kilometers in sit skis, double pulling the entire thing.
Yeah.
It's like, holy cow, are they fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Georgia, thank you again. Dan in Maquanago, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'm calling just to put it on the plug for retailers. And anybody who makes a living during lousy winters like this, like to encourage people to go out there and perhaps, you know, buy some wax, buy some new skis, do something to help these people stay afloat. They usually are multi seasonal, but right now we're in a season that isn't too kind to us.
Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for that. And
amen, brother. we're well stocked with snowshoes. Our rentals kicked off hard, obviously, when it started snowing. So it's seasonal businesses are really tough, and I'm sure there's people up north, especially, who are struggling. There's Mel's and Riselander, and that's one that comes to the top of head. But there's lots of great retailers all over the state that do this.
Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for calling. It's an important thing. And you do sell, as you say, you sell snowshoes and associated equipment.
Yeah, we sell modern shoes. The places to get the traditional shoes, I haven't found them to be, I don't know how to say this especially. It's not that they're not of good quality. It's just... They're expensive, and the ones that I make and sell cost considerably more than that. But the weaving on them is tight. People go to my Facebook page; they can see pictures of them. It's Facebook, yeah. You know. Canoe Lover is my my user ID. But there's pictures of that. There's also some pictures of the snow camping that I just did.
So. As well, yeah, which is a pretty really cool photo that you've got of that tent and the surrounding area. It's just beautiful.
And the water had just dropped, so there's this beautiful ice shelf around the sandbar. I mean, I was better to be lucky than good, right?
You can join in too, by the way. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Carol emailed us. She has a question about the shape of the snowshoe. Should she get one that is rounded on both ends or rounded in the front and pointed in the back, and why should she do it?
Great question. So, snowshoes, if you look at like a map of the U.S. or of the North America and overlap the kinds of shoes that were used by the indigenous people, you'll find that they're very different in shape. And the reason they're different in shape is they have different strengths and weaknesses. So the ones that are rounded to both ends, it's usually called bear paw or modified bear paw. Yeah. Those are really maneuverable. So if you're walking through the woods, through trees and stuff where you need to turn, trappers traditionally use bear paws because they're, you know, crouching down, working on a nice fishing rig or a trap or whatever. And then you go to places that are more like the plains. Like the snowshoes I built are Ojibwe or Cree style. Both tribes use them. And they're long and skinny with pointy ends on both ends. And the reason for that is when you walk through a prairie, the front will push the grass out of the way. And then there's in between, which is, you know, round on the front and narrow in the back. The tail gives you kind of like a rudder. It kind of keeps the shoe going direct. Generally, I mean, I use all kinds. I've got some that I've built that are, most of the ones I built are the Cree or Ojibwe style because they work best around here. But I've got other ones as well.
The thing I like about snowshoeing, or one of the things I like, when I first got a pair, I put them on and I could use them right away. I didn't need a whole lot of experience or training to use them.
Yep. Some people say, how do you get into snowshoeing? I said, well, if you can walk, yeah, then you snowshoe. And so the two things I tell people when they're just first getting into it, number one is start with poles. Just like cross-country ski poles will work, or just something to give you a little bit more balance. And secondly is don't walk with your legs too far apart, because sometimes people will kind of waddle, and your IT band just will start screaming at you. So just use a regular gait, and the shoes should nest, right? So when you walk, they shouldn't hit each other. And if they do a little bit, that's no big deal. But yeah, don't try and not have the shoes hit each other, just pick up your foot a little bit more.
Yeah, that all very good advice. I've been lucky enough to see some snowshoe racing.
You know,
it is quite an operation.
So the way I look at it is human beings will find a way to race anything, right? I mean, they have those bathtub races, right, where they put wheels on a bathtub and push people through town. And a lot of people who do snowshoe racing, long distance snowshoe racing, they're runners, and they use a very small snowshoe because you really don't need much because it's compact, right? So it might be 10 inches long and 4 inches wide. There is a race. It's still a race. There was a race at the Badger State Games that was, you had to use traditional Alaskan shoes, which are 12 by 60. And, that was, I gave up racing for Lent, right? I mean, I go out to not go fast.
You know? Yeah, I know. But I was amazed at how fast.
Well, they're marathoners, right? So they're running six and a half minute miles with snowshoes on. And I mean, if I can run a 6.5 minute mile, maybe 20 years ago.
it was a lot of fun to watch. I really enjoyed it. Jen in Madison emailed us, Tim Gattenby at the UW has a whole host of programs for people with differing abilities. In addition, the UW-Madison's occupational therapy program assists people with exploring new activities and bridging the gap of any impairment. And Clara, maybe you can put that information up on our page. The ideas at WPR.org/Larry after the show or when you have time. Tim Gattenby and the other, the occupational therapy program.
It's surprising what people can do. I mean, that's the thing is for, you know, most of history, I was like, well, sorry. And a lot of the friends I have that are in chairs who are, you know, paraplegic or low quads, they didn't get that way sitting around the house. They got that way mountain bike racing or skiing or doing active sports. So it isn't like that feeling just goes away. Right. So I've had friends that are wheelchair racers. I have friends that are, you know, do bike hand cycles. Competition doesn't go away just because your body changes.
Gloria wonders, how do you find the best way to introduce kids to outdoor winter sports?
Always take them out before they get cold.
Yeah, quit before they get cold. Too cold.
Right. And this I use this for canoeing as well. It's 15 minutes per year of age. So that's how long they can take it before they go nuts. And if they're saying, I want to stop, daddy or mommy or whatever, grandpa, you're just past where you need to be. So make sure they're warm. Make sure they're bundled up. They get cold faster because they have little tiny bodies, right? Don't push them. You know, there's an igloo thing you can get. I can't remember what they're called. It's like a form that you can make snow bricks out of. And you can build snow forts, build igloos. If you want winter camp with them, if you got snow, make a Quincy hut or a shelter in the backyard and sleep out there for an hour and then go inside where it's warm. But exposure is what works. I mean, my kids learned how to paddle before they could ride a bike. And now it's just part of who they are.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. Well, you have, of course, you have canoes and kayaks, lots and lots of them. And you've got 43 days to Canoocopia. I want to bring that up before we get to the end. Canoocopia is...
Yeah.
Some people may not know about it.
Yeah, it's the world's largest paddle sports expo. I can't say world's largest on public radio. It's a significant paddle sports event here in Madison. We just finished our speaker schedule. That'll go up on the website soon. Over 110 presentations this year. It's a rendezvous, modern day rendezvous, right? There's commerce that goes on, of course, you know, we sell stuff. But mostly it's a gathering of community and education. And love it.
Man, you're going to find everything, anything you ever wanted. And from a whole variety of makers of equipment.
And you know, the best stuff in the world is fine, but if you don't know how to use it, it's just a paperweight in your garage, mm-hmm. right? So the educational component of the show is very important to me because I want people to know how to use what they have.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've enjoyed in the past years. You've had been on the show to talk about it and then maybe have had one of the speakers join in as well. And that's always fun to hear from one of them.
Well, we've got some new folks coming. We've got a guy coming from the Northwest Territories and from the Yukon. We've never had anybody from the Yukon before, and that's going to be great. So yeah, it's expanding geographically, which I'm really happy about because, you know, it's a big world. There's lots of places to paddle.
And then the dates for that, just so get that out of the way.
March 8th through 10th.
March 8th through 10th. So it's coming up, actually.
Yes, it is.
And if you go to Rutabaga Paddle Sports or Canoocopia online, you're going
to
find...
Yeah, if you go to rutabaga.com, there's a link to it.
Yeah. A listener emailed us, a novice snowshoer, and wasn't sure if they could wear any of their winter boots or look for a kind of... You need a special kind of boot to wear with snowshoes. Any advice on that?
You don't really need anything special. I mean, Sorels work really well, any kind of winter boot that's insulated. But if you just have a hiking boot and it's not too cold, you definitely want something to put on to keep the snow out of your boot. And there's things called gaiters, which clip onto the lacing of your boot and go around the boot and then go up your leg just under the knee. And if you have those on and they're installed properly, you won't have snow go down your boot. And that's one thing that a lot of folks use.
Yeah, and a lot of reasons why people don't get irritated when you get... that's happened to me. You get snow down your boot.
It's happened to everybody. It's just when it's really deep, especially. I mean, I wear a little pair of snowshoes going out to my wood pile just because I hate snow inside my boots. It drives me nuts.
And just to go along with, Matthew just emailed us. He went snowshoeing in deep snow, and despite wearing gaiters over his hiking boots, the back of his thighs got wet from the snow thrown up from his shoes. And he wonders, what kind of pants do you recommend that are cool enough while exercising but keeps your legs from getting wet?
And traditional shoes do throw up quite a bit of snow in the back because they're kind of spring-loaded to keep the toe up. I mean, there's plenty of different kinds of things. Just a pair of rain pants works fine. They don't breathe as well, but they work. But there's also kind of a winter tight that has some wind blocking to it, but it's more breathable. And you see the skiers wearing them. That's not so much the super fast guys. They're in Lycra, right? The rest of us are wearing just kind of a pair of tights that are a little thicker and a little warmer.
Yeah, absolutely. Clara just let me know that the link to Adapted Fitness Program is on our website. She's got it up already for those who were talking about assisted help for many, many people. And we've got that link up there. And, of course, we've got the link, I'm sure, to Rutabaga.
And if you want to see the wheelchairs that are motorized, they'll be at Kanikopia. They have them there.
Wonderful!
They're like little bobcats with seats in them.
Yeah, they're great.
Yep.
Darren, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Always fun.
It is. Thank you for having me.
Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports of Madison, got a great new building out there, and we've got Kanikopia coming up. I'll probably be talking about that down the road a little bit more as well. Great to have him with us. Well, if you're out there snowshoeing or cross-country skiing, you're probably not going to see a badger. But our next guest is doing a lot of research, or it has done a lot of research, on the badgers right here in Wisconsin. We're going to learn about that, and she will answer any question you might have about our state animal, the badger. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Well, Wisconsin is known as the Badger State, but you probably haven't seen a badger in the wild because they're most active at night. I've been lucky enough to see one in the wild once when I was out pheasant hunting with some friends, and it was a magical experience to see. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Emily Latch is our guest today. She's a professor at UW-Milwaukee with a focus on biodiversity genomics, and led the Wisconsin Badger Genetics Project. And it's great to have her with us today. We'll hear more about the project and take your questions about badgers. Were you lucky enough, like me, to see a badger here in the state, or maybe it was in a zoo? I know they're in most of the zoos here in our state have a badger anyway. But talk about why maybe you love our state animal. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Professor Emily Latch, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Oh, well, it's great to have you with us. Well, as I said, I doubt that many people have seen a badger in the wild, or not as many as probably would like to have. How many badgers do we have in the state? Do we have any idea?
Isn't that a great question? Yeah, I agree that most people would love to see a badger in the wild, and they are really difficult to spot. As you said, they're nocturnal and they live underground most of the time, so they're pretty difficult to spot. Also, they like prairies, right? So when the grasses grow up above the height of a badger, you aren't going to see them even if they are running around. I don't know how many there are in the state. I wish we knew. Right. So when we first started this project, badgers were listed as a species with information needs by Wisconsin. So we just didn't know enough about them to say really much of anything. So after our study, we discovered that they are throughout the state. So even though you may not have seen them, they're out there. So they've been reported in every county in Wisconsin, and they seem to be doing really pretty well.
So tell us a little about your background. What led you maybe to teaching at UW-Madison, or Milwaukee, excuse me, and your interest in badgers?
Yeah, so I started off with an interest in genetics, and I got a bachelor's degree in Pennsylvania in genetic engineering. And that was amazing, right? It was an amazing experience. But when I realized that I could apply all those cool tools and ideas that I was learning to wild animals, I was hooked, right? So I went to do a PhD at Purdue University, where I was working in a wildlife management department. And I looked at, used genetic tools to look at reintroductions of wild turkeys. I also worked on mule deer and river otters and sturgeon and all the wildlife that makes, you know, the United States as great as it is. But they all had a focus on using genetic tools. And then I worked at the Smithsonian's National Zoological Park in Washington, D.C., where I did some conservation genetic research on endangered Amazonian birds and some threatened desert tortoises. With an incredible group of scientists. And then I came to UW-Milwaukee in 2008. And one of the projects that we started up almost immediately with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources was to study badgers in Wisconsin. So what a wonderful introduction to the state.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story. I love it. Willem in Colfax just has a comment for us, I think. Let's go there. Hi, Willem.
Hi. Early in the spring, I saw three little badger cubs sunning themselves at the end of their hole or whatever, their burrow, and they were adorable. And then last fall, I saw some legs between our car and our truck where we park, and I thought it was a woodchuck, which I had seen, and I was worried about one of our kitties being out there, and I went around, and I came around the side of the truck, and it was a badger with its cub, a young badger, and I was maybe, you know, like 4 feet away, and it lunged at me, you know, with its claws and its teeth, and it hissed. I backed up and it ran away. So then I found it had been burrowing behind a shed on our property, which I didn't really want because, you know, I put kitty litter down there, and I plugged it up with some heavy slabs that I had, and I tried to discourage it, and then I found the other outlet in our garden, and I anyway, I got them to move out of our yard anyway, but I do see them from time to time, and they're beautiful.
That's a great story. You're one of the lucky ones, Willem, that's for sure, and I think Emily would agree with me on that.
Yeah, for sure. It's really great that you've been able to see them. I agree that the badger kits are about as cute as they could possibly be. And to see them is really incredible. And so it must have been a nice surprise in terms of trying to discourage them. There are a lot of different strategies, each one more creative than the last, for trying to discourage badgers. But once you have a spot that is pretty good for digging and a healthy rodent population for, you know, some snacks for them, they like to stick around.
Yeah, and they can dig.
They are very efficient diggers. They're very well adapted to do it.
Those long claws can really get going for sure. Well, and Willem also mentioned the burrows. Talk about the burrows. What are they like?
Yeah, so they can be a lot of different things, right? So badgers go into torpor during the winter, so they are not very active right now. So they dig a burrow, a pretty extensive one, and then they will usually kind of hunker down. They'll awaken to eat and go to the bathroom and then kind of slow down again. So But they use their burrows throughout the year. During the summer and fall months, they tend to move burrows around a lot more often. And so maybe every couple of days, they might move to a new location and sometimes miles away and dig a new burrow. So during this summer and fall, it can be a little easier to discourage badgers from being in your, you know, near your shed. During the winter, they might be stay put for a little while, but they're also not very active, so you might not even encounter them.
Now, Willem thought there, and maybe he's right, maybe he's not, but he said he had the hole behind the shed, but then he found he called it the exit hole in his garden. Is that the case where they're, you know, it's just, there's just not one way to get out, or?
Sometimes, yeah. I think they're pretty clever, and so they will dig burrows so that they have multiple exits. That seems to be a pretty good strategy. So, yeah, they would do that.
So, and they're nocturnal. They don't like other creatures. So it's got to be tough to study them.
Yeah, they are nocturnal. They live underground for the most part, and they do have a bit of a reputation for being ill-tempered. They also can't be tracked using radio collars, so collars that send out a radio signal that you could use to track animals, because their heads are shaped like spades, right? They're shaped like triangles, and so the radio collars just slip right off their heads, and so it can be really difficult to track them. Another way that we might traditionally track animals is to put a pit tag, which is an injectable, like a microchip tracker that you might have on your pet. They can be challenging also because badgers live underground and can move really long distances. So we use genetics to track animals and to study them. And so DNA is a really good marker because it's found in all living things. It doesn't change throughout an individual's lifetime, and each individual's DNA is unique, like a fingerprint, right? So like an ear tag or any other tag that you might put on an animal, if you sample the DNA, if you sample the same DNA at two different points in time or in two different locations, you know that it came from the same individual animal. And so as that individual leaves offspring, it leaves that genetic legacy, those shared portions of DNA, right? And so since we know that DNA is inherited in this predictable manner, we can use it to track populations over time.
Penny in Altera, Minnesota, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I've been dying to see a badger at least somewhat up close. I'm not sure if there are badgers near my home because I live at the end of a dead end where the gravel road is between farm fields. And this fall, I just saw these burrows with huge piles of dirt, good-sized holes alongside. And I never saw any clear tracks because the dirt was so loose. They kind of filled in. So I did see a few spots where it looked like an animal was laying and making an indentation. But I also want to know if it was badgers, what would be my best way to get to see them? Like sit in the evening and watch, or, you know, just wondering how I might get a chance. And if it does sound like a badger burrow.
Yeah. So badger burrows can be really similar to groundhog burrows. And so you very often see these big mounds of dirt and this burrow entrance, and you're not sure if it's a groundhog or a badger. When you mentioned the belly scrape, that does sound an awful lot like a badger. You might see with those really strong foreclaws, you might see scrape marks along the sides of the burrows. So that's another thing to look out for. It does sound like it might very well be a badger burrow, which is really exciting. To see them, like I said, at this time of year, they're pretty inactive. So you probably won't catch them very often outside of the burrow. But as spring comes along, depending on if it's a male or a female in there, you might have some kits to see, like we've heard about before, which are adorable. But they will certainly come out of their burrow more often. It'll be at nighttime, so that, you know, I would recommend, you know, dusk or night or just before dawn kind of stuff. Also, a lot of people have trail cameras, and if you can't see them in person, which would be the best thing, maybe the next best thing might be to try to catch it on camera. One of the things throughout our Badger Genetics Project was people sent us a lot of trail cam photos, and each one was better than the last. It was just so great to see everybody's pictures of badgers. They were just in so many different habitats doing so many different things, and it was just amazing to see them all. So we appreciate everybody sending us the pictures, both for research, but also just to look at them.
And Penny, you might set up a trail cam just to make sure that what's there is actually a badger. That wouldn't be a bad idea at all. And frankly, trail cams are a whole lot of fun. They're a whole lot of fun. Thank you, Penny, for calling. Emily Latch, our guest today. Professor Latch is a professor at UW-Milwaukee. She focuses on biodiversity genomics, and she's doing some really cool, has done some really cool research on badgers, and we're going to learn more about that after we take a quick look at the news. We'll be back with our guest, Professor Emily Latch, at about 6 minutes after 12. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about badgers on the show today, our state animal, with our guest, Professor Emily Latch, a professor at UW-Milwaukee with a focus on biodiversity genomics. Emily led the Wisconsin Badger Genetics Project. So as we talk with Emily, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an experience to share about a badger or a badger burrow, or maybe you can talk about why conservation is important to you when it comes to badgers. Maybe you contributed to the Badger Genetics Project. We had lots of people do that. And what was that experience like? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And we have Christina from Glenwood, so let's just go there and see what's on Christina's mind. Hi there, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. I've seen lots of badgers in the summer, so I didn't realize that it was unusual. I was at a friend's place. We were walking in the woods, and we saw a family of five with three kits. They were so adorable. And then on my farm, one day I was pulling into my driveway, and I saw what I thought was a groundhog carrying a baby. It dropped it, so I got out of the vehicle, walked over there, and saw that it was actually a dead woodchuck. It looked so little in this big badger's mouth. And so I scooped it up in a plastic bag, and the badger ran into the grass, and then he'd come out, and he was kind of snarling, and I'd clap my hands, and he'd back up, and then he'd come out, and then he'd back up every time I clapped my hands. So it was a really fun experience, and one thing I love about being out in the country.
Christina, thanks for calling. A nice experience, but you were stealing that badger's food, probably. What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, I think it's no surprise that he must have been hungry that day and was looking to retrieve his lost prize. So, yeah, it was really amazing that you get to see them. I agree that it's really cool that they are around and that you get to spot them, and that being out in the country is a perfect spot to do it. You mentioned that they were in the woods. That's a really awesome point, and part of what we discovered when we started asking people to report badger sightings was they are everywhere. Badgers are normally considered to be a prairie associated species, so grasslands and dry prairies. And so we weren't sure where we would find them within Wisconsin, maybe just in the southwestern portion of the state. We weren't sure. And when reports started coming in and we started getting trail cameras and we started looking at habitats, they were everywhere. They were in forests, they were in agricultural fields. We found them in pretty much every habitat we could have imagined. So that was a really exciting part to what we were finding. And it sounds like it's something that you've known all along.
Yeah, the one that I saw was in a marsh. We were in a marsh pheasanting, and that's where we saw the badger. Vicki in Millador emailed us. This is kind of a fun story. She's seen badgers a few times in her woods over the years, but she had two incidents in daylight really surprised her. She spotted one about 20 feet away as she was walking into the woods. It stood up and arched its back like cats do. She kept walking as if she didn't see it, and it dropped down behind a log and disappeared as if it were a balloon deflating. And she was in a tree stand when one came down the edge of a flooding creek. She wondered if it was stuck on her side of the creek, but it jumped right in and looked like a furry cushion zipping across as if it did not even sink in the water.
Yeah, they're fast.
And they can swim.
Yeah.
Someone else wondered, how long do badgers live?
It's unclear how long they live in the wild, right? We don't know if we're seeing the same one or a different one from year to year, but in captivity they live about 12 to 15 years.
Yeah, that's probably on the long side, because in captivity they're fed and they're
well taken care of, for
yeah,
sure. Yeah,
if they get sick, they get treated, and so that's probably the long.
It probably is.
Jim from Lafarge called, couldn't stay with us. There are many badgers around his house, and now there aren't many squirrels. Badgers would take a squirrel, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. Badgers will take any. They're opportunistic carnivores, so they will take anything that they can get their little claws around that's probably smaller than a groundhog, so pretty much anything.
Well, let's talk more about your research. First, the overall goals of the research. Give us those.
Yeah, so the overall goal of the research started out with just trying to understand a little bit more about where badgers are and how well they were doing in the state. Like I said, they were a species with information needs, which is a really dissatisfying category to be in, right? Being the state animal. So we just set out to see where they were and how well they were doing. And again, we used genetics to be able to do that. So traditionally you would capture animals and take a blood sample or a tissue sample and extract DNA from it that way. As we've talked about today, the badger is pretty elusive. It's difficult to find. Trapping is pretty inefficient. But if DNA can be found in nearly all of your cells, then we can extract it from samples of feathers or hair or scat that can be collected without even handling the animal at all. So for badgers, we used hair snares. And so what we did was relied on all you wonderful people in Wisconsin to report badger burrow sightings to us. And then we would go out to those burrows, set up a hair snare in the burrow. So like a comb to gently comb the badger hair and get a few hair samples. At the tip of a hair sample is the follicle where it attaches to the animal. And that in that follicle is DNA. And so we had a website, a phone hotline. We recorded all activity that people reported to us. And then we collected hair snares from badgers as they entered and left their burrows, and then used those hair samples to extract DNA.
That is really cool. And so you had to rely on help here in the form of average citizens then.
Not average citizens, superhero citizens. Enthusiastic badger supporters. So yeah, I mean, everybody was amazing. And, you know, I had only been at UW-Milwaukee for about a year when I started this project, and the outpouring of support and enthusiasm and interest and interaction was just incredible. And so what a awesome introduction to the state. And we ended up with over 500 verified reports of badger activity. And I mean, verified like trail cam photos and you know, people collecting cell phone videos of badgers running around. And so during about the 4 years or so that we did collect reports, and so we heard about badgers from all over the state, which was fantastic news. And then, you know, we used some genetic data to, we sampled about, I think it was about 250 badgers across the state, collected genetic data from those. And it revealed that, you know, badgers are pretty healthy in Wisconsin. They have robust levels of genetic diversity. Populations are well connected throughout the state. There aren't very much, there aren't very many barriers to badgers moving throughout the state. They were doing pretty well, which was fantastic news.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris in De Pere has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you. So I've had two close encounters with badgers. One was just a preteen little boy playing in the woods, laying down behind a berm or whatever, and a badger actually came out and brushed up against me and walked away like I was nobody's business, didn't care at all. And then a decade or two later, I was in the military in Idaho and going across the field on maneuvers, jumped behind a berm, and two or three came out, and they were pretty snarly and wild. I actually got up and ran away. I didn't care about the war games at that point anymore. Is it common for them to work in teams like that?
No. Yeah, not really. So they're mostly solitary. It kind of depends what time of year. So again, if they're, you know, so the baby badgers, the kits, will stay with mom for, you know, pretty much till the end of summer. So they are born in the spring and they stay with mom till about the end of summer. So if you saw a group of them together and they were all pretty good size, I would guess it was probably the end of summer or early fall before those kits then disperse and find their own territories. But yeah, not normally together, but if they are, they may be a family.
Thanks for calling, Chris. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Jill wants to know the difference between American badgers and European badgers. They seem much gentler in Europe, Jill says.
Yeah, very different, right? So there are lots of badger species all around the world. The most common ones that we know about are the American badger, because it's here in our backyard, and the European badger, which is throughout most of sort of Northern and Middle Europe and Asia. So that badger is in a different genus. It's Meles meles, and we have Taxidia taxis here in the U.S. And they are quite different, both in look and in behavior and in, as you said, sociality, right? So European badgers are friendly. People, you know, have them in their gardens. They're social animals. They live in groups, right? You might, if you're going to see badgers in groups, it'll be the Eurasian badger. But there are also badgers in Africa, which have an even more ill-tempered reputation, honey badger. And there are some badger species in Southeast Asia as well. And so they're smaller and also live underground. One of the things that we are trying to build up research capacity to do right now is to look at badger genomes, to look for those genes that are involved in adaptations to living underground. So badger species worldwide have all of these really cool adaptations for living underground. They have really strong forearms for digging. They have really long claws. They have spade-shaped bodies. They are adapted to hypoxia, so a lack of oxygen that you would have underground, or reduced oxygen. And so we are interested in seeing whether those adaptations arose sort of in similar ways all around the world, or if they're really different adaptations for these different habitats in which they live.
David emailed us. He just heard you recommend trail cams to capture images at night. They may use lights or infrared lights. If you put those outside a badger den, wouldn't this harass a badger? David was saying, please use cameras without light to get images by moonlight.
Yeah, you can definitely get images by moonlight for sure. I know that one of the ways in which it could be one of the strategies that you might use to discourage a badger from, say, being in your garden or underneath your shed might be exactly that, to shine lights near it to discourage it, to encourage it to move somewhere else. And that is a strategy that, you know, nuisance animal removal groups might recommend. But if you're excited to have your badgers nearby and on your property, then I agree that using moonlight would be a really good way to get pictures of badgers at nighttime. We did receive a lot of pictures during the daytime, and we've heard some callers today who mentioned seeing badgers during the daytime. So they are active during the daytime, just more active at night.
Kelly in southern Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Larry. This is Kelly. I just had to tell the story about how my dad accidentally caught a badger in a trap. They were trapping woodchucks. It was a live trap. And anyway, they went out the next morning to see what they had caught, because, you know, they don't like them burrowing under the barn. And it was a woodchuck or a badger. Anyway, they're like, oh, how do we even grab the trap? Because this thing was not happy. And he said they eventually threw a coat over the top of it, and they loaded the trap with the badger in it on the back of a flatbed truck. And they took it out into the field miles away from the barn, and it took them a while to figure out how to actually undo the door to the trap. But they did manage to get it open, and the woodchuck would not, or the badger would not jump off the back of the truck. So they ended up, it came out of the trap, but it wouldn't jump off. So they ended up, every time it would get to the end, they would step on the gas. And finally, it fell off the back of the truck.
My goodness. That is, that, I imagine you've heard a lot of badger stories in your time, Emily.
Yeah, a lot of them involve the ill-tempered reputation. You know, I think in general they want to be left alone, right? They want to be able to do their badger thing. But yeah, if you accidentally catch one in a trap, it could be an unexpected adventure, I guess.
Renee in Vernon County saw a lot of badgers growing up. She emailed, her mother told her not to bring one home. That's probably good advice.
Good advice.
Very good advice. Oh, my gosh. What are the biggest threats to badgers, or are there many threats to badgers?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think as we encroach on their habitats, they're more likely to be nuisance animals, right? They're more likely to be in people's gardens. They're more likely to be under people's sheds. And so, you know, conflict with humans is always a danger to wildlife. I think probably one of the most dangerous times for badgers is when those young leave mom and disperse across habitats. They're going far distances to find new territories, and they are running around to do that. And so they cross roads, they cross railroad tracks, they cross all of the dangerous places for wildlife. And so that's probably their most dangerous time, is sort of late summer, early fall, when they're making that pulse of dispersal.
And I have seen, I saw one alive in the wild, but then I've seen a couple dead along the road too.
Yeah, and actually we collected a fair number of samples from people who reported roadkill animals. And so we also collected, we made use of those animals by going out to those locations and collecting samples from those roadkill animals and collecting DNA data from those animals as well. And so even though it's a sad outcome, it's nice that we were able to use that data as well.
So are you furthering the research on badgers? I know your lab is also doing a lot of other things, and I wanted to talk about that too.
Yeah, right now we're trying to secure funding for the badger genomics, the worldwide badger genomics adaptation work that I talked about a minute ago. I'm trying to figure out what those key innovations are that badgers have around the world and how they evolved. So we're working toward that now, and that's probably the most badger work we're doing at the moment. But yeah, our lab is working on a number of different wildlife projects, both in the realm of conservation and management.
Maybe give me a specific one or two.
Yeah, so, you know, our lab's motto is variety is the spice of life. So we continue to work on a wide variety of species. For example, we're using genetics to develop tools for monitoring chronic wasting disease in white-tailed deer, which is another big issue in Wisconsin. And we're collaborating with partners in Wisconsin and across the U.S. You know, Wisconsin residents know more than most about this devastating disease and understand that controlling it is really challenging and yet a high priority for both wildlife health and public safety. So we're using genetic data and genomic data to better understand susceptibility in white-tailed deer, to better predict transmission and spread across the landscape, and ultimately to improve white-tailed deer management and CWD surveillance and control programs.
So that is, that would, boy, if you can make any progress in that area, that would be really, really important to this state.
Yeah. So that's been a pretty big focus of our lab, sort of more closer to home. And, you know, I have an amazing student right now who's working on more of a conservation project looking at genetics to assess the Grenada frog. And the Grenada frog is a critically endangered frog that's found only in high elevation forests in the Caribbean island of Grenada. And so we're working with the Grenadian government and local organizations like the Milwaukee County Zoo to help bring awareness to this little known frog and to develop effective conservation strategies. And so the diversity of projects that our lab works on is pretty wide, but they all center on this using genetic and genomic tools to advance conservation and management.
Yes, it's really, really cool. I spent some time in Grenada, as a matter of fact, on a project, actually a project throughout the Caribbean, but I spent quite a bit of time in Grenada a long time ago now, but I haven't forgotten the country. It's a beautiful place and a lot of fun for me. So your website, what's the web? We'll post it up. We have it up on our page, I'm sure, but tell people what your website is, because you've got a lot of really cool stuff about and information about that Badger project.
Yeah, the Badger Genetics Project is sadly over, but the website is still active. And so if you just type in Wisconsin Badger Genetics Project, UWM, right? UW-Milwaukee, you'll find it right away. And so there's some good badger facts on there, and there's a little bit, there's some maps on there of where we got, where we received reports from, and a little bit of links to our genetic and genomic data. There's some good pictures that people have sent of burrows and of badgers. And so you can get your badger fix at the website.
And Claire, just let me know, we do have that up on our website, ideas@wpr.org/Larry, you'll get the link there. Emily, it's been a real pleasure. You're doing some great work. Thank you so much for talking with us, and I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. It was a pleasure.
Emily Latch, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She focuses on biodiversity genomics. That's a really cool and interesting stuff, isn't it? We'll find another reason to talk with her. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about road salt, spreading salt, one way to make us safer, but we'll take a look at the impacts on our environment as well. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.